Once again, I want to thank Dr. Kirshen for doing the logistics to arrange the shiur, including the CME credit, Bayit Adult Education, the Bayit for making the copies. I would like to ask two things. Number one is I'm looking now at topics for next year for the CME series. So if you have ideas for things you'd like to see discussed, email me, let me know. That's number one. And number two, God willing, I will send out later today, tomorrow at some point, a link for the online, the sheets are over there, a link for the online evaluations. We require the evaluations for the sake of being able to offer CME credit as well as useful feedback. So if you could please fill out the evaluation, it's really a short form. And whether you're getting CME credit or not doesn't matter. They want the evaluations from a certain percentage of the attendees. So it would be helpful. The topic for this morning is genetic screening. And I need to give a disclaimer at the outset because you'll see what the disclaimer is. The discussion we're going to have for the next hour or so assumes that the screening exam we're talking about is reasonably reliable in terms of both specificity and sensitivity, meaning in the sense that when it says yes, the answer is yes, and when it says no, the answer is no. Because when you deal with these exams, and mammogram is the is not a genetic screening, but it's a perfect example of it. When you have tests that either have many false negatives or false positives, the entire discussion becomes almost irrelevant in the sense that we're talking about the question of, I have the ability to test. Do I do it? Do I have to do it? How do I inform people of the results? If I don't have a good test to work with from the start, then the whole question goes by the wayside. And then the question is a different one of, so what counts as a good test? What counts as a test that I'm going to be confident in? So I'm assuming right now that we're talking about tests that are reasonably reliable without really getting into what I think is a good separate discussion of what constitutes reasonably reliable. So we're clear on that, just knowing that everything I say is going to be assuming that we're talking about tests that are reasonably reliable, and we'll be using examples of tests that I think do meet that standard. You can see the vignettes on the sheet, interspersed with the different sources. So the first question that we're going to take is the question of Sarah, age 25 and of Ashkenazi descent, lost her mother and grandmother to breast cancer, each in their early 60s. Sarah would like to be tested for the BRCA gene, but she is concerned that this would demonstrate a lack of faith in God. Should she refrain from being tested? Now, it's not enough to answer yes or no. You have to support the conclusion. What would you say to Sarah asking this question? So Harold asks, does she get her blood pressure tested when she goes to her family doctor? Meaning?
That's a screening test. There's a problem. It's treated. It's not just avoiding problems. How is this different?
So the argument by analogy is, we do other screening things that aren't about genetic screening, so if we can do those, why can't we do this? So the question I would put back to you is, how do you know you can do those? It's really a global question. It's not unique to this particular treatment.
Well, yeah. God wants us to, I think, make our own efforts to, and then once we put forth the effort, then he'll give us the help we need. So I definitely don't think it demonstrates a lack of faith in God.
Right, so one approach is to say, this is what God wants of us. This is not against God. This is doing what we've been empowered to do. But take a look on your sheets, please, at source number one, the comment of Ramban. The reference there on the sheet, I'm looking at it now and realizing it's a typo. It's not Devarim 38:13. There is no 38:13. It's 18:13. My apologies. But he writes, he's commenting on a biblical verse that says, Tamim tihya im Hashem Elokecha. You shall be complete with Hashem your God. So he writes, "V'tam tamim tiyayim Hashem alokecha." When the verse says, "You shall be complete with Hashem your God," it means "Shaniachel levaveinu elav levado," that we should dedicate our hearts to God alone. "V'na'amin shehu levado osek kol," and we should trust, we should believe that God alone does everything. "V'hu hayodeya amitas kol asid," He is the one who knows the future. "U'mimenu levado nidrash ha'asidos," and we should only turn to God to find out the future. "Miniviyav," from His prophets, "me'anshei chasidav," His pious people. "Ritzoni lomar urim v'tumim," meaning the urim v'tumim, the breastplate worn by the Kohen Gadol. That's where I'm supposed to turn. Now, I could distinguish between Harold's case of the blood pressure test and the case of the genetic screening by arguing that Ramban would be okay with a test that reveals something right now and not necessarily with one that's predictive of the future. The blood pressure test may do both. It may indicate a problem now, but may also indicate something is developing. So I'm sort of hedging by saying that. But Ramban, once Ramban introduces this, we now need to ask ourselves the question of, so what is my justification for any number of predictive things that we do? So the truth is, we have three halachic reasons, maybe two, to test. Reason number one for doing this, and I'm going through this in short order because the more complicated questions are still coming. This one is the gimme at the outset. But the reason number one is simply that rather than compare it to, let's say, a blood pressure test, we would compare it to the things that we do in the normal course of everyday behavior. There are all sorts of things that we do to protect ourselves that aren't even medical. That one might argue, hey, well, that displays a lack of faith in God. Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote about this in source number two, dealing with Tay-Sachs testing, and he writes, "Kevan sha'ata nasa zeba'ofen kal livdok." He says, since it's easy now to test, yesh li don't shim eino bodekes atzmo. He says it's an easy test to do. So a person who declines to test is like a person who closes his eyes as he's walking and says, well, I don't want to know. I don't want to see what's coming. He says, you don't close your eyes. You have to see what's coming down the road. And he says, since it would be extraordinarily painful for the parents, if this were in fact to happen, if they were to have a Tay-Sachs child, it is appropriate that one who is going to get married should do the test. He says you should publicize via newspaper and other means that there is in fact such a test. Rav Moshe says, absolutely you do it. And as far as the question of faith in God, opening your eyes as you're walking in the street doesn't constitute a violation of your faith in God. He hasn't really explained why. He simply said it as a statement of fact. This is normal human functioning. This is what God intended for us. I suppose you could argue that his logic is, if God didn't want us to look, he wouldn't have given us eyes. This is a straightforward part of human existence.
Does length of survival matter?
For the individual case at hand? In other words, you're predicting something 30 years down the road, 50 years down the road. Is that what you're asking?
No. The prognosis for Tay-Sachs has changed based on what type it is nowadays and some of the treatment. I mean, we've got a child who's 22 now with Tay-Sachs.
Really?
Service. Yeah.
Wow, I had no idea. That's interesting. I don't think it would change his fundamental point. The point, when he makes the point about the great pain that would be involved, that's his reason for pushing people to test. It's not his justification for doing the test. So, understanding what you're saying there, and that's, I had no idea of that development, that's important knowledge. Nonetheless, I think his point stands that it's easy to do, and therefore it should be done. It's part of normal function. Alan?
He didn't want us to know why he invented the test to be done.
Sorry?
Why did he invent the test to be done if he didn't want us to know?
So that's an interesting argument. Why would God have made it possible if he didn't want it? To which, what's the obvious answer? God makes an awful lot of things possible that he doesn't want us to do. right? I know, in all seriousness. The creating the option doesn't necessarily mean that it's something that he's okay with. A second argument, and this is the one that I'm not sure is a valid argument, is the argument based on source number 3. It's a classic source where we are told in the Gemara, since the Torah says, in the case that one person wounds another person, so the assailant is responsible to pay medical bills, v'rapo yirape, he shall heal him. Therefore, we know there is license to heal. Why you need license to heal is its own discussion. It's a longer discussion than we're going to do right now. We've discussed it in other contexts. However, the argument goes, since we are licensed to treat people medically, therefore, we're licensed to test. That's part of medical treatment. The argument in response would be, I'm not sure this is really medical treatment. You're not treating an existing problem. It doesn't actually do anything to heal the problem. All it does is predict something for the future. So I'm not entirely convinced that that's a valid argument. But the third argument sort of goes to what Alan suggested as a broad theme. And that argument is that technology is fundamentally a tool that God has given us. Despite the argument of, well, God also created things that he doesn't want us to have, that I just made before, take a look at Ramban in source number 4, where Ramban writes, Nasan Lahem, this is on the Pasuk in Bereshis, in which we are told that Hashem says, I've given you all the grass and the fields, and you control the animals, and so on. So, Nasan Lahem, Kamachum, Mshala, Ba'aretz, Lasos, Kirtzonam, Bebehemos, Ubishratzim, Vacholzo, Chaleafar. That God gave human beings power over the earth to do as they wish with the animals, the crawling creatures, all those in the dust. Velibnos velakor natua, to build, to uproot that which is planted, meharat lachzo nechoshes, to mine copper from the hills, and so on. God gave us dominion over the earth, and that includes the technology that we have. The Rambam writes this as well in his commentary to the Mishnah in Nedarim regarding Yechezkel and the regarding Chizkiah and the Book of Cures in the days of. In the days of King Chizkiah, it's a longer discussion, but the Rambam writes there that that technology is considered a tool that God has given us to use, and if it doesn't violate any particular prohibition in the Torah, so okay, then it's permissible for a person to use it, and one need not be concerned that use of that technology is now taking the person away from belief in God. And that's really the Rambam's main point there. The reason I brought Ramban instead of bringing Rambam is just because I brought you Ramban to prohibit in source number 1. So I want to show you that there's another source in Ramban in source number 4 that seems to be a point in favor. In practice, yeah.
Well, one could argue about the difference between permitted and necessary. So in other words, you might be able to do it, but you have to heal to do it.
Right, and that's something I want to get to. We're going to, God willing, we're going to get to that question. It's a very important one. As Dr. Libman points out, the fact that it's permitted does not necessarily translate into an obligation. That's something we have to see. Eddie, are you going to say? Okay. In fact, the halachic authorities I have seen on this, including Rav Moshe in source number 2, but also by J. David Bleich, an argument in an article in Tradition by Mordechai Willig in a shiur that's available online on yutorah.org, they all endorse this. One point that is important to note is that we avoid putting such faith in the test that we lose hope for the future, meaning that, you know, it's not as relevant in the Tay-Sachs case, because in the Tay-Sachs case, it's sort of on-off. In other words, if they test positive, then they don't marry the spouse who has it, and who has the other gene. But in a case in which a person does, let's say, a BRCA gene test, and the test turns up positive, that doesn't mean that they now abandon all hope. First of all, because we know quite well that people with the gene are not guaranteed to develop anything. That's a key point. But number 2, take a look at sort. Yeah.
What about acting on it? Like, for example, if she takes this test and finds out she's positive, is she permitted to act on it, having a sex preemptively?
Right, so that we still have to get to. It's a good question. Hold on. But take a look at source number 5. This is a comment of the Shach, Rabbi Shamsai HaKohen, on Shulchan Aruch Yerodeya. He's talking about assisting somebody who is on the brink of death to recite vidui, to admit their sins. So in the the Shulchan Aruch makes the point of saying that yes, we tell the person it's time to confess their sins, but we also try to make sure they understand that this, that doesn't mean they're going to die. We say many people have done vidui multiple times and survived, which is true. It's not just something we say, it's true. So we want to make sure they understand it. Take a look at source number 5, where Rav Shabbosai HaKohen comments on that line in the Shulchan Aruch, saying, Nira didavka benata lamus omrim lo hisvadeh. He says, first of all, it appears we only tell the person confess if, to the best of our knowledge, the person is dying. Dim loken choshev shemesukanhu, because otherwise he's going to think he's in danger and his heart is going to break. Inami alternatively, we don't say it to him yet because, you know what, he has time to do this on his own. He doesn't need to be told. The point is, we don't want to tell people to do this unnecessarily. We don't want to kill their hope for the future. So even though testing is considered appropriate, we have to be very careful in the way that we present it. Yeah, and when people go for genetic screening of various kinds, they have genetic counselors whose job, in part, is to explain what the test means and what the test does not mean. Because people misunderstanding what the test means could cause tremendous psychological and emotional damage and cause them to make bad decisions. Yes?
Does it matter if the person says a long form of Kriyat Shema?
In other words, that's a vidui question. Is this really necessary?
Yeah.
On Motzoi Yom Kippur, we say Shmona Esrei in Maariv, and we include Slach Lanu Avinu. Why are we doing that when we just ended Yom Kippur? So the answer may be because we stepped on somebody's foot as we were dancing around the bima, or because someone got annoyed that we were dancing so long, and now we've upset them, and therefore we need to say Slach Lanu Avinu, or because the person said Hashem's name without Kavana in the earlier part of Maariv, and now needs to apologize for that. The point is, Averos are easy to come by. So I don't think a person would lose by saying this vidui, even if they say vidui every night. That would be my feeling. Okay, so that's in terms of the question of violating one's faith in God. In vignette number 2, we ask the next question, which is: Sarah tests positive for the BRCA gene. Should she tell her fiancé? If she doesn't tell her fiancé, should other people tell her fiancé? Is this something now that the fiancé ought to know? So we do have a rule normally that says that one is supposed to disclose to a prospective spouse things that the spouse would be concerned about. You don't want a situation in which there is a mekach toz. Someone enters a relationship thinking that they know everything they'd be concerned about and something was not disclosed. That's a general rule. So if you take a look at source number 6 from Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, writing about 700 years ago, in the Sefer Chassidim, he says, Lo yichase adam mum b'nei beiso, im tzrichen banav al krovav lehiz daveg. He says, if a person has members of his household who need to get married, he's not entitled to conceal their blemish. Im yesh lem choli she'ilu ha'yodim osam ha'mizdavgim imahem oso choli, lo ayu mizdavgim. Then yigal elahem. If they have a disease which were their prospective mate to know about it, they wouldn't in fact marry them. He's not entitled to conceal that. Now here it's not even talking about the person who has the disease, it's talking about the parent of that person. And the concern is pan yomru ki dushei ta'us hayu, otherwise they may say the marriage was based on an error. That's the Sefer Chassidim's position. And it's codified by the Chafetz Chaim in source number 7 in his Laws of Rechilus. Rechilus is tail-bearing. So he writes there that im hu ra'a she'echad rotzeh lishtadech im echad, if I see two other parties, one party wants to marry another, or they want to lishtadech is really for it to be arranged. V'yadua l'ra'a hazek yachasan yesh lo chisronos atzumim. And he sees, the onlooker, the observer sees, that the prospective groom has great defects, great flaws, which he's going to have to define. The kfiyah muvur lekamansi vav manikra chisronos linyinze. V'amachutan eino yodea mizeh davar. And the person who is going to get married to him, or the family, they don't know. They wouldn't go along with it. Then you have to inform them. What qualifies as such a defect? So he writes, if it's a physical disease. In other words, it's not that the person has some kind of bad trait, but it's actually a physical disease. And the person that they're going to marry has no way to know that, has no way to know about it. It's something that is internal, it's not visible. Then for sure he says there is no prohibition against gossip. And Rabbi Yaakov Breish in his Chelkas Yaakov goes even further and says one who fails to disclose it is guilty of lifnei iver lo sitein mechshol. They're leaving a stumbling block in front of somebody because they know that that person is going to get married without information that would have been important to them. So my question now to you is, would this apply to the case of the BRCA gene? Jack, was that what you were going to go to?
No, I'm just kind of assuming that, but who is it? Is it any person that has this information?
Correct. 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 All of those. And we talked about this question a while back when we got a share on confidentiality and the question of how do you do it. So I think it was Esther at the time who, and maybe not, maybe it wasn't you. You said something about finding other ways that information, something like you may want to look into or something that would disclose without disclosing. This is a really good question. Are you expected now to violate the code for physicians and actually tell somebody about this? So the answer is maybe not. It depends to a certain extent on the seriousness of what's involved. And we still haven't answered the BRCA gene question. But basically, one would not be expected to surrender his livelihood in order to aid someone else, other than possibly if the person is facing physical harm, like death. But otherwise, it's not clear that you would be expected to do this in order to save the person from a problem, particularly if there are other ways that this person could find out the information. But let's ask the question in the simplest form. Am I not a physician? We have a general duty to rescue in Judaism, right? I have lo samad al dam riecha, don't stand by while the blood of your brother is shed. So do I have an obligation to convey this information in this case, in the BRCA gene case? Yes?
So the BRCA gene case is a little bit different because if the person has because first of all, it's only a risk. It's maybe an increased risk, but it's only a risk. Also, the reason they did the thing in the first place is because there are all kinds of family members who died of breast cancer, which should be obvious to the person. So if he doesn't ask, maybe he either doesn't want to know anymore, or in any case, it's just an increased risk. She doesn't know she's going to get breast cancer. Certainly it's not exactly the same as the case that's given here where the person has a physical disease
right,
or a flaw.
So Dr. Justin gives 2 points. Number one, if you look back at the Chafetz Chaim, he said, if you're talking about something that could not be known, right? Here, in this case, assuming it's public knowledge within the community that this person had relatives who passed away from it or who developed it,
it's not public knowledge. The guy's going to know, like, she didn't have a mother. Like, he's going to know her family history, hopefully, a little bit.
I don't know.
Especially if it's her mother did die of breast cancer, you're right, if it's an arranged marriage.
No, it's a good question. Well, in arranged marriages, they tend to know more, not less. That's my understanding of the way those work. But that's one point. Is this is available information? And point number two is that the positive result for this gene does not necessarily mean that they're going to develop it, both because there's only a certain percentage of those with the gene who develop it, and number two, because unfortunately, awful things happen to people at all times in their lives, and they may not live long enough to even develop this. So, take a look at source number 8, where Rabbi J. David Bleich argues. He principally argues from the point that the person may not develop it. Number one, the test could be a false positive. Number two, they may not develop it. So he says, in light of that information, it is doubtful that any rabbinic authority would require or even permit a third party to disclose the BRCA carrier state. Even permit. In other words, he's saying, I wouldn't be allowed to tell that. It would constitute rechilus, tail-bearing. That, however, does not imply that a young lady should not disclose such information to a prospective fiancé at an appropriate time in the developing relationship. In other words, we're addressing this without sort of the human side of the question. It may be true that I'm not supposed to tell, and that she is not required to tell. But that may not be a good idea for their relationship. One imagines they get married, and then she turns to him and says, by the way, that doesn't bode well. So they may need to tell for that reason. Albert first had
I was going to say, I don't think breast cancer is really the issue. The screening that's available, the self-testing we can talk about, and the rest of it, I don't believe breast cancer is the issue. Ovarian cancer, however, is a different story. Much more difficult to find, much more likely to be fatal.
Right.
So I don't think breast cancer is a question.
Right, and that's a good point I didn't mention, I should have mentioned, is that even if they do develop it, that doesn't mean that they're going to, God forbid, die from it. There are screening methods. There are things that can be done in order to mitigate things. We haven't yet dealt with the question of the preventive mastectomy. That's something that we still need to get to. But the bottom line point is, even if she does develop it, that doesn't necessarily translate into great suffering in the future. Eddie.
So I understand that we come to the conclusion that a third party is not required to disclose. Yet it's still a good idea for the fiancé herself. Is there a requirement for the fiancé to disclose
on the halachic requirement? Right. So Rabbi Bleich thinks that it's not a requirement from a halachic perspective, but that it's a good idea.
So if she goes into the marriage without giving the knowledge, and then
it would not constitute fraudulent grounds. It would not invalidate the marriage. That's correct. Yes.
You know, it works the other way too, because the male can be the carrier if it's on his own. It's not settling. Okay. So. If a male has lost a mother and a grandmother to breast cancer, they also have the same obligation to be tested. And it bodes differently because their offspring might be carrying it and their daughters might develop it. So, you know, I think it should have been a more general case because it goes both ways, male and female.
Right. Interesting. You're looking at this in a way that I did not, meaning I was looking at it in terms of the person herself manifesting it, where yeah, I know males can get it, but my understanding is that it's a much lower.
They can, but we're talking offspring.
Yeah. Right. You're looking at it in terms of offspring, so I'm going to the offspring. I'm not on the offspring yet.
Right.
So, but I hear your point.
But T-Sams, I mean, yeah. This isn't the same implication.
Right. Right. Agreed. Other questions or thoughts on this before we move to the next step, Jack? What if they refuse?
Yeah, I guess it's possible. If there isn't anyone else.
Right. No, I think that counseling is appropriate. I would agree with that. Esther?
If you really want someone to know something, you could always send an anonymous letter.
Right. My problem with that is the very touchy question of the code. You know, we need to have a system in which patients trust their doctors to keep things quiet, and the damage that could do to the broader system is non-trivial. I think I would worry about that. If there's another way to handle it, I would prefer another way first. You know, my goal is not only to get them the information, but my goal would be also to make sure that the system wasn't broken in the process.
Of course, the system is broken anyway.
That may be, but I would look for other ways if I could. I think there's also a separate problem here that has to be addressed in this, and that's the concern for stigma that's associated with this. The meaning, if word gets out that somebody has a particular carrier gene for a genetic disorder, that can create problems for marriage for them, for their family members, even where there is no gene It's a big problem. So that Ramosha Feinstein famously said that it should not be disclosed, and he suggested the method that's used, in fact, still by Dor Yesharim in Borough Park, which is the confidentiality method, in which they will have the young man get tested long before he's ever dating anybody, and they assign him a number. And then they have young women get tested long before they're ever dating anybody, and they assign them a number. And when two people are, when someone wants to arrange a shidduch between two people, then they'll contact Dor Yesharim, give them the two numbers, and Dor Yesharim will either say it's a healthy match or it's not a healthy match. They're not going to say which side has it, and they're not going to say what it is that's the problem. They test for several different diseases. They'll simply say, do or don't do. And that's based on Rav Moshe's idea of confidentiality. Rabbi J. David Blyach was horrified by this idea. In his article on this in Tradition, which I already referenced, in source number 8, he says what you need, in fact, is a push for education. That people should understand what a positive test means and what it does not mean. Because his argument is that creating a system in which you don't tell people just furthers the stigma and the sort of bugaboo, aspect to it. It becomes a taboo discussion in conversation. And in general, he feels it's actually more destructive to society to do that. Better to promote a clear understanding of what a test means and does not mean. And that will help people not only in terms of testing and encouraging more people to get tested, but it'll also help with getting treatment for things. As long as it's better, if people know better and understand better, you create a healthier environment. That's Rabbi Blyach's argument. Yes?
And I can see that because if using the Dor Yesharim method, I think it will come back and say there's a problem. You don't know if it's you or the other.
Correct. No, that's their point.
Yeah.
Is that you shouldn't know.
But it creates a problem because, they may be both carriers.
It depends on which disease you're testing for, no? Some of them require both being carriers.
Right, that's what they're actually testing for. The one that requires two testers.
Got it. Okay. Well, then you right. Then you right, but you don't know which disease it is, but you'll know that it's both.
You know that you both have.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yes.
Presumably, if they found that there is a gene for a disease that is potentially fatal but treatable.
Say that again?
If they're testing for a gene that is predictive of a disease which could be fatal but is treatable, they would have an obligation to tell the individual.
So as long as you're talking about something that's a carrier, it's not a guarantee.
So they're not testing for that.
Yeah, that's correct. Okay, so I want to move on because there's a whole lot to talk about. I will only add that in terms of the concern for stigma, Rav Moshe Tendler is on the record in an article that I think I referred to later on. I didn't quote it on this piece, but it's an article that's in number 14. So that's the reference. But Rabbi Moshe Tendler, quoted in source number 14, says that you should avoid indiscriminate testing. You should only have testing within populations where there is reason to think that someone might actually have it. He opposes the indiscriminate testing. But let's go further here. Once we've said that it's not a violation of faith to get this test, and once we've said that you're not obligated to tell the fiancé necessarily, unless there's some kind of a guarantee that this is going to develop. We're talking about something other than the BRCA case. Is BRCA testing required? Would somebody be required to actually have this test? What would you say? Would a woman who is of Ashkenazi descent have some obligation to go for this test?
Like every Ashkenazi woman?
Yeah. Would there be such a requirement? Well, if she's Ashkenazi, beyond that, I don't have any history. I just know that she's Ashkenazi.
So what's the purpose of her own?
For her knowledge, to be able to have a higher level of screening, perhaps.
Nothing to do with shidduchim or anything.
Nothing to do with shidduchim. For her personal health. Sorry?
My understanding is that's just not in cases where the family history.
Okay, but I'm asking a halakhic question in a vacuum. In other words, let's say a woman is asking the question of, I'm willing to pay for it. It's not going to be covered by my OIP or whatever it is. I want to know, should I go get this this test?
Probably not, because it's al tamud.
Meaning?
Causing harm.
What harm am I causing by testing?
You're increasing her cancer phobia rate.
Well, she's already got the phobia. She's asking whether she should be tested.
No, you're saying she's insisting on being tested.
Yeah.
You're worsening her cancer phobia.
Okay, I hear that. Yes.
Your question seems to change. Are you saying, first it sounded like you asked, should all women be tested?
Well, I'm dealing with...
You're saying, should we allow women to test? You're asking if all should all Ashkenazi women be tested. Well, it's really no different than any other population at risk for high blood pressure or sugar problems.
Correct.
Whatever. So.
So
we don't obligate them to test themselves.
Really?
Is
that true? If someone has a history of hypertension in their family, we don't require that they make sure to have their blood pressure tested. Yeah, that's yes.
I'm so sorry.
I would think they would be obligated.
The last 2 words I said, do we?
I think we do. I think there is an obligation to pursue medical treatment for not only that which is currently causing a person to be ill, but that which the person is can reasonably anticipate is going to occur to them.
So she insists, and you're saying, are we going to refuse? I don't understand what you're asking.
My question is, let's frame the question this way. She goes to the rabbi and says, I am an Ashkenazi woman. Okay? Frame the rest of the question however you wish. I have it in my family, I don't have it in my family. Whichever one you like. I want to get tested. What does the rabbi respond to her? Esther?
I think it would be a healthy thing for everyone to know their gene status, and then they can do preventative action. You know, you might be potentially on some train track, and a train may be coming.
What about the phobia that Dr. Gershon points out?
I know, but most people are going to be negative. Mm-hmm. And then you get a lot of reassurance value. If you are positive, you've got the train coming. Mm-hmm. And I think want to know and do preventative action.
Okay. Well, I'll give you what I've seen written on this, and that is that where there is reason to suspect that the disease is present, and reason to suspect requires a certain threshold, it isn't sufficient to say, I'm Ashkenazi, in order to trigger it. There has to be some family history. What the percentage risk has to be in order to trigger this is a really good question. I don't think it's clear-cut. But where there is reason to suspect, then there are two halachic reasons to pursue testing. Number one, v'nishmartem ma'od l'nafsho seichem, the halacha that you have to protect your life. If you take a look at source number 9, Rabbi J. David Bleich makes this point, in which he, in his article he writes, but there is a halachic obligation to undergo procedures designed to disclose evidence of a malignant disease. Mammograms, breast examinations by a physician, self-examination, and the like. He's saying, is there? It's a question. And if yes, is there an obligation to determine one's carrier status in order to make such diagnostic procedures more effective? I'm going to come back to that point. I haven't discussed that one yet. Is every woman obligated to seek BRCA screening, or are only members of high-risk groups obligated to do so? I suspect that the intuitive answer is that such obligations do exist. Citation of the verse, V'nishmartem ma'od l'nafshoteichem, and you should be exceedingly watchful of your lives, is virtually an automatic response. That's his statement. He then continues to say, genetic testing, including testing for BRCA1 and BRCA2, should be regarded as halachically mandated in circumstances in which medical science believes that the results are likely to affect treatment in a manner that will enhance longevity, anticipation, or well-being. Certainly, a person identified as being at risk for a specific disease is obligated to pursue all available measures in order to ward off the disease or to diagnose its presence while the disease is yet in an incipient stage and still amenable to cure. His argument is, if it's going to enhance survival possibilities, and if medical science believes that that there's a reasonable expectation that this is going to develop, you have both points here, then yes, he is in favor. Not all medical treatments fall into this. Not all medical treatments are considered to be required. Rabbi Yaakov Emden notes in source number 10, that something has to be considered an effective treatment in order for it to become mandatory. And how you determine whether something is effective is actually a really good question. If you take a look at source 11, where Moshe Isserles, the Rama, in the Shulchan Aruch, talks about eating something non-kosher as a cure. And he writes, Mutter lisrof sharetz o shar devar yisur ula achlo lerefua afilu choloshen bo sakana. You're allowed to burn a creeping, you know, a crawling creature or some other non-kosher item and eat it as medicine. In other words, they tell you that if you have the powder from this bug, that's going, or this lizard or whatever it is, that's going to heal you. So he says one is allowed to eat that even if he's not in danger. Even if he's not in danger for his life, but it's a treatment for something. And then he says, you can only do that in the event that it's a known cure, something recommended by an expert. You need to have some kind of knowledge of effectiveness. So the Rama's position, Rav Moshe Isserles' position, is this has to be known to be effective in order for it to be something that we're going to recommend. The Rambam in source number 12. Right, so I'm not going into the whole pill discussion right now. It's a good question. I'm only bringing this for the principle that he establishes regarding needing to know that this is an effective cure. There's a lot to discuss, and I think we had to share at one point on pills. That's really a separate piece. The Rambam, on the other hand, does not seem to require that the cure have an established track record, but that it be logical, that there be a logical explanation for why it should work. Is his standard in source number 12. He says, one may not violate a mitzvah other than for a cure which is clear, obligated by logic or experience. Right? That's what I have there for you in number 12. Now, he's dealing with a different circumstance. Rama and Rambam are talking about where you're actually violating a prohibition. Right? Eating something non-kosher. That's not the same as our case. But my point is only that there are standards for developing a trust in a treatment. And the standard may be experience, the standard may be that there is a logical explanation medically for why it should work, and that would be sufficient to say, okay, this is something that we should be using. But one point that Rabbi Bleich made in source number 9 that I glossed over, he says, is there an obligation to determine one's carrier status in order to make such diagnostic procedures more effective? And what he's referring to here in this is the idea expressed by Rabbi Akiva Eger. I did not bring it on your sheet. Rabbi Akiva Eger makes the point that when people know to look out for something, they're more careful to do so. He's talking about the interesting question of shechita performed by a minor, in which we say that if someone is supervising shechita by a minor and he sees that everything was done properly, the shechita is kosher. Whereas if someone is supervising shechita by someone who doesn't know all the laws, but the supervisor doesn't know that the shochet is ignorant, then the shechita is no good, even if everything looks like it was done all right. You follow? Where I'm supervising a minor, it is good. Why? Because I know that there's something to look out for, and therefore I'm going to be extra careful. If I'm supervising somebody who I think is probably fine, so I'm just checking off the box to say everything is good, then I'm not as careful. So that's the point that Rabbi Akiva Eger makes regarding shechita, and Rabbi Bleich borrows this to say the same thing is true regarding testing. Meaning, if society is just giving routine mammograms, I know that now they're being discouraged because of the problems with false negatives and false positives. But let's say you're dealing in a society in which they're giving mammograms routinely, even where there's no known history, so the doctor is not necessarily looking that carefully. Whereas if the doctor knows my patient has a family history, her mother had it, her grandmother had it, her aunt had it, then the doctor is going to be a lot more careful. And if the doctor knows that this person tested positive for the BRCA gene, then the doctor is going to be more careful, is going to pay better attention. So that may be a reason for doing the test, because it means that you'll be more careful with the screening methods that are available. That's number one. Number two, the other reason to do it is theoretically to protect the intended spouse. Because since we've said that one who has the knowledge perhaps should be disclosing, then maybe now we should be pushing for people to test in order to be able to disclose it to the other party. There's a lot to say about this, but we're already 45 minutes in, and there's still a major piece that I have to get to. So what I'm going to do is refer you to source number 14, where Dr. Ari Mozenkis has an article on this topic, and he refers you back to number 13. Take a look at 13 and 14 if you want to email me afterwards to ask me about it, or maybe I will include it in the email follow-up that I send out from this talk. Maybe that's what I'll do, because I don't have the time to do it right now. But I'll do it in the email. That's the way I'll handle it. Okay. Next question. We have now said that it's not a violation of faith in God to test. We have now said that if a woman develops this, she may not be obligated to notify the spouse, but it could be a good idea. Or if you have something that she does know she will develop based on the testing and that the spouse would care about and so on, then she actually does have an obligation to inform them. We've now said also that testing where there is reason to suspect a problem, not just testing at random, but where there is a family history or something, testing then may well be a requirement. So if screening is indeed so appropriate, does that automatically translate now to saying people should employ PGD? PGD is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And what it means is that when they are going to have children, instead of saying, well, we're going to try to have children and hope for the best, what they'll actually employ is IVF, where they'll take the sperm and the egg, they'll match them, they'll develop the embryo, and then test the embryos to see whether they have this, whatever it is that we are testing for, and they'll only implant the embryos that don't show this disease. That's what we're talking about when I refer to PGD. Are we clear? So the question now is, if they're testing positive for this, do they go the extra step now and say, let's do PGD? Now, all PGD has to come with proper education to understand its valid implications. I'm not going into a whole PGD discussion right now. But the problem with PGD is not really with PGD per se, but with IVF. The IVF presents certain halachic challenges. The issues include, number one, getting the seed from the man in a halachically acceptable way. That's number one. Number two, making sure that they have appropriate procedures in place to ensure there's no confusion, that the seed comes from the man and not from some other person. We've all heard the stories about mix-ups in labs, which, despite the fact that everyone is aware of the problem, and despite the potential for lawsuits if you get it wrong, nonetheless, every couple of years you hear a new story on the news about somebody who was the product of a mix-up. So that's something that's very serious, and when PGD is done, and when IVF in general is done in Shari Tzedek, as I understand it, they actually have supervision to have somebody observant watching, observant in both senses of the word, to ensure that there's no confusion. There are authorities who require that you make sure that the woman is not a Nida during implantation. There's concern that that may be considered a violation of the laws of Nida. It also will require some form of birth control, right? Because if you're doing IVF, but they're not using birth control, then you may well end up with a situation in which they end up with a child who is born the natural way, and you've now ruined the whole purpose of your IVF and PGD. So they're going to have a form of birth control as well. I talked to Rabbi Dr. Steinberg when he was here a couple of months ago about this particular issue, and he mentioned that they had come up with a method in Israel which they felt confident would satisfy all sides on the issue of the birth control. He described a method that they've come up with, and because it was a late night, Friday night conversation, I'm not sure I'm going to quote it properly. I'd rather not quote it improperly. But because of all of these issues with IVF, halachic authorities tend to permit this specifically where there is reason to believe that there really is a problem. like an older sibling was born with this or a test was done and they're both carriers. It's not something done willy-nilly. It's not something that's just done, you know, I'd like to have an extra level of protection against problems. It's also not something that's done because the person wants to have their child have blue eyes. It's done to avoid serious problems. However, it then begs the question. Let's say you do IVF. Let's say you do PGD, I should say. And you find something unfixable in the embryo. Now what? In other words, they match sperm and egg, they produce the embryos, and they found something that they cannot, that gene therapy is not available for. Now what do you do with the embryo that you've created? So in order to answer that question, we have to ask, in general, why is abortion a problem in a Jewish law? Because depending on the reason why abortion can't be done, that will determine your result when you're talking about an embryo.
Why are you talking about abortion if it's still in a test tube?
Because I need to know whether the problem of abortion will apply in the test tube, and in order to know that, I need to know why abortion is a problem in the first place. In other words, some issues will apply to a test tube, some issues will not. So one view is that the problem of abortion, you can see it in source number 16, is that it's actually considered like murder. It's considered to be shedding the blood of a human being, even though it's actually inside the mother. Not dealing with a test tube yet, dealing with regular abortion so far. That's one argument. Others contend differently. Others contend that the problem with abortion is actually that it's wounding the mother. That the fetus isn't considered alive. This isn't a shear on abortion. That's why I'm not going through this in detail. But in source number 17, you find the position of Rabbi Yosef and Moshe Trani the Maharit, who argues that that Tosfos believes that the problem is not wounding the kid, but it's actually an act of wounding the mother. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein thought that was absurd, and he actually believed that it wasn't written by the Maharit. He believed that a student put that into the text in the Maharit. Maharit never said it. Ramosha is in Igros Moshe Choshen Mishpat Chelik Beis. It's Tshuva Samach Tes Gimel, and then Tshuva Ayin. So anybody wants to look at that can see that there. But the third argument is that it's Chavala against the fetus. It's wounding the fetus. The argument is the fetus is not truly alive. However, you're still wounding it by aborting it. And then the fourth and last argument by Rabbi Yair Bachrach, the Chavos Yair, is that it's Shechva Zera Levatala, Hutzah Zera Levatala, you have produced seed in vain by destroying the fetus. And that's the fourth argument. Let's turn these to the pre-embryo now and ask which of these will apply, if any. So if it's an issue of murder, go back to the pasuk that they quote in source number 16. The pasuk is Shofech Dam HaAdam BaAdam, shedding the blood of man inside of man, or inside of a human being. In other words, that verse only applies to shedding the blood of a human being who's already inside the mother. This is in a test tube. It's not inside the mother, and therefore it would not apply. The prohibition of Shafech Dam HaAdam BaAdam will not apply to the test tube case. It's not an issue of wounding the mother, even if the Maharit did make that argument, because it's not inside her body. It's not an issue, according to the Sri Deish, Rabbi Gil Yaakov Weinberg, it's not an issue of wounding the fetus either, because you can't wound something that doesn't have any limbs. It's just a bunch of cells. There's no wound to speak of. It doesn't fit into the halakha category that's called chavala. And as far as wasting the seed, so I talked to him by Dr. Avram Steinberg when he was here, and this I do remember because I have it in writing from him. He said he argued that will not apply to the pre-embryo because the seed was produced with the intent of creating life. It was not done in vain. And this embryo is an embryo that's not suited to live. And in fact, if you were to implant it, you would only be creating this, you know, let's say the baby with Tay-Sachs, who, again, not knowing where technology is going to go with this, but has this very limited life that's going to be available to it. So he said, for you not to implant it, or even to actively destroy it, is not going to be a problem of wasting it. It was produced for a purpose, and now it's not viable. It's not usable. Yes?
What if it's for the breast cancer gene, like BRCA1 or BRCA2? So that means this fetus would actually have life, but we prefer to implant the one that doesn't.
Right.
So could you abort at
So, right. So here's what I will say. Here's what I can say on this question. Number one, halachic authorities are adamant on this, not to extrapolate from one case to another. Meaning they say, we want to deal with each one as it comes up, because each one has unique circumstances. And I'll give you a case of that at the end, but I want to make sure to get through this first. We do have the following precedents, though. Rabbi J. David Bleich is quoted in an article by Dr. Daniel Eisenberg as opposing destruction of pre-embryos. He, in general, opposes destruction of pre-embryos. He is the harshest in this on the spectrum. Rav Eliashiv, as well as Rav Yeshua Neuwirth, author of the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa, and a major authority in medical halacha until he passed away 2 years ago, both of them permit destruction of zygotes, of pre-embryos, for certain terminal illnesses. That's not necessarily BRCA gene. What about where there are extra pre-embryos that you can't implant? So Rav David Feinstein is recorded as permitting not implanting them. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu takes it as a given that one could actually discard them. He says that it's not a problem. One could discard it. Rav Moshe Sternbach, I brought in source number 18, says destroying a pre-embryo is really abstaining from surgery to implant it. That's really all it is. In other words, it requires an intervention in order to implant it. So all you are doing is not doing that, not implanting it, and then at that point you just allow it to deteriorate, and that would be it. That's what he writes in source number 18. Rav Chaim David Halevi, the major halachic authority in Israel of the previous generation, says there's no issue of destroying it pre-implantation. Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz, the Av Beis Din for the Rabbinical Council of America, permits even creating pre-embryos for use for stem cell research. So they would certainly not have a problem in this case. It seems like the argument is to be lenient in this regard. However, all of them discuss the case where you're dealing with a particular illness that's been predicted that you have a high confidence is going to develop. I'm not sure that BRCA meets that standard. I would be very leery, and I refer you back to this point that he makes about the point that I made in general about not extrapolating from one case to another. So I would be very leery about that. One question that was asked before that I didn't get back to, so I want to just get back to it now and then let you go. But the question was asked, what about the preventive mastectomy? In a case of someone who has, in fact, tested positive for this. So my understanding is that treatment from a medical perspective is highly controversial. That there are those who argue, and when I say those, it's a lot of them, apparently based on the literature that I've read, that it's inappropriate unless you're dealing with a case with what I'll call, for lack of a better medical term, very high risk. Someone who had it throughout their family and they tested positive for the gene and so on. But that as a general rule, medically, it's an extremely questionable procedure. Unless you would have a doctor who's trained in it saying, this is something that ought to be done, the question wouldn't begin from a halachic perspective. Halacha isn't going to go further than the doctor in predicting it. Halacha may endorse it once the doctor says, this is a requirement for you to protect your life because of whatever, but a halacha is not going to go beyond the doctor in requiring it. That's my understanding. Jack?
I have some traces of that. There are religious patients who come to me and they insist they're having trouble conceiving and they have to even that has to do sperm analysis. What did rabbis do to develop the dollar with respect to the situation in terms of getting sperm?
Right. So I haven't looked into this as a practical question recently, so I don't want to make a mistake with this. My understanding, though, is that what they usually require, if at all possible, is that it be collected via normal sexual relations. That's what they usually recommend, is my understanding. Thank you very much. I will send out an email, God willing, following up and including that piece that I had to skip. But, thank you. And please